Could I tell you a little bit about Satan? That in the court of heaven, Satan is the district attorney. He is not, as Christians imagine, the enemy of heaven and the enemy of mankind. He's merely the person who sees the bad side of things and carries out the dirty work.
Something that I find repulsive about especially monotheistic messianic religion. With a large part of itself, it quite clearly wants us all to die.
A new consciousness is developing, which sees the earth as a single organism and recognizes that an organism at war with itself is doomed.
Welcome to the Deferred Gnosis Podcast. I am Shay Belay.
And I am Matt Johnson.
And it is a sincere pleasure to be here once again. We have a great show planned. We have a couple of topics we want to tackle. We're going to have Christopher Wilkie. He's an artist that I've had huge respect for. Have you had a chance to look at his stuff?
Fantastic pieces of art. I mean,
fucking
just mind-blowing.
Stunning.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very good. Very good work.
Hauntingly beautiful, torturous, artistic paintings.
So we look forward to an excellent interview with Mr. Wilkie at the end of the show.
We're going to have him on, and it's going to be wonderful. But firstly,
here we are, new studio, Glass Hat Studio in Tustin, California.
Yeah, we've been changing studios so often. I mean, the first one...
It's hard to stay on top of, actually.
I forget where the fuck we
are. I'm fucking dizzy at this point.
The first one said that we were bringing dark energy to the studio.
Yeah, imagine that.
Oh, that's just bad.
You would have think that, you know, casting incantations and slaying babies in the fucking studio or something like that.
We weren't doing fucking... I wasn't doing rituals. I wasn't doing rituals in the middle of our fucking recordings. You're an atheist.
I'm an atheist.
How dark can you get?
There's nothing to it for me. Yeah, I'm not bringing anything. I'm like a blank sheet of paper. Christ's sake.
So by that, he just meant just our topic.
It made him a little uncomfortable, and yeah. So
we had to move on. We moved on to another guy, and he said he canceled.
Studio number two turned out to be a little lacking kind of in punctuality.
Professionalism?
And it kind of became unreliable. So here we are.
Here we are.
Third time's a charm.
We've got David on the control.
Yep, wonderful guy, doing a great job.
Yeah.
I think, Shay, this place has promise. I think...
Well, we've got this wonderful red light shining on us right now.
This is a great mood lighting.
Yeah, I feel like it's sex light.
I think...
going on. It's like a porn. This is like a porn filter.
It feels homey. I think we finally found a home.
Yeah, this feels good. Yep. This definitely feels good.
And we're allowed to drink, which is...
Well, that's excellent. In the last place, he told us we couldn't.
We actually had to sneak whiskey into Pepsi bottles in order to drink inside the studio. I mean,
dude,
it was
like
being
fucking...
16 again.
Yeah,
it was like, what am I, at the fucking theater?
Am I going to lose my virginity during this fucking podcast recording?
<It's>
that
like
was a fucking joke.
It's like the movie.
And the guy running it was like...
Well, I don't want to slam.
I don't want to slam too hard.
But, you know.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Enough said. Here we are once again. Glass Hat, David at the controls.
Yeah. I got to kind of. I'm drinking this coffee to try to get into the groove.
Yeah, get your wire going.
Because I had about 4 hours of sleep last night, man.
Because
I was with you, we were drumming up notes for this.
Yeah, we were actually at
the
local.
It was like 2 a.m.
We were at the local local diner eating.
No, Denny's. You can say Denny's. What do you feel like you're going to give them advertising revenue?
Denny. Dinner at Denny's.
Like you're afraid to say it. Dude,
I had a veggie fucking omelet.
We were there drumming up notes for a podcast while people are coming in like half drunk from the fucking
people were
local
stumbling
clubs.
Yeah,
and so I had 4 hours. Then I had to jump to my history.
You had class this morning.
I had class at fucking 9 a.m.
Wow.
And, you know, U.S. history, it's every Saturday morning should be filled with genocide,
yeah.
Teenage pregnancy,
indentured servitude,
slavery, syphilis, smallpox, the whole thing.
And all of the other charms that came about in what, 17th? What
the
era?
16th, 1700s, the establishment of the colonies. You know, this is one fascinating fact that I actually learned in class. So, from the 1600s, about 1660s, to the early 1700s, the population went from 500,000 to 2 million in the colonies.
Whoa. Yeah, we're talking about a fourfold increase.
In about
100, 120.
Yeah. So 2 million in the early 1700s. Now,
the population explosion.
Yeah, of course. Well, the average childhood birth experience,
the birth rate,
7 per female.
7 children.
7, and 3 of which survived. But that's
a survivability rate, less than 50%.
That's not even the most shocking part, though.
A long ways, guys. Rejoice.
The most shocking part to it is that of the 2 million, half, 1 million, were age 16 or under.
50% of the population
is fucking 16 or 16 under.
16 years or under. You can imagine the kind of shenanigans and debauchery.
So our country was founded by raging, violent, genocidal, religiously fanatical
teenagers. Whoa. That's quite a realization.
Mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but it makes sense.
It does make sense. I mean, with a population explosion like that, I mean, you have to have a young population.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Wow.
But speaking of religiously fanatical, you know, you and I have had private conversations where we've talked about, there's a lot of things going on in the religious landscape right now.
Right.
You know, we have experiences where you have, you know, in the States, we have so much as open and affirming churches. We have gay, same-sex marriages in the Christian church.
Right.
And then at the same time, you have that contrasted by the extremes of ISIS.
Right.
That are beheading people and upholding Sharia law.
Right.
And doing all this. And in our private conversations, we've discussed how literally people interpret these biblical scriptures, the Quran, the Bible, Old Testament and New. And you said, well, these progressive Christians, at least the ones that are in the West, these ones that uphold these progressive issues, oh, we're okay with gay marriage, we're okay with sex, we're okay with premarital sex, so on and so forth.
Right.
I've heard you say, well, they're not Christian.
Yeah. Okay. So, I want
to bring this to the podcast because I think this is an important discussion to have.
Right.
I think it's very important to disambiguate what's
absolutely, and it's an issue I feel fairly strongly about. As an atheist, I would like religions and religious people to be honest and to be truthful and forthright about what it is they believe in. And one of the inconveniences that comes along with calling yourself a Christian, just to pick an example, is that you are intimately tied to the teachings of God. You're intimately tied to the Holy Bible. If you're going to call yourself a Christian, identify as one, then your canon is the Holy Bible, which is promulgated as the word of God.
There's two avenues I go down.
One, the first is, with regard to the Reformation of Christianity. Now, there's no debate about whether or not it's been good for society as a whole. I mean, obviously getting past the Inquisition and medieval Christianity.
It's the blind murdering of
drowning witches. If you drown, well, sorry, you were
yep.
not a witch.
If you didn't float,
if you float, you're a witch, and we're going to kill you anyway, and we're going to burn you at the stake either way.
You're fucked either way.
So obviously, it's good for us as a whole that the Reformation of Christianity has taken place. It's a good thing. My contention is that I think it's tough to continue calling it Christianity, and I think that if you don't look at the Bible and acknowledge the fact that it's anti-gay marriage, it's anti-homosexuality, it's anti-masturbation,
these messages seem pretty clear to the detractors. I mean, these messages of anti and violence, they almost seem clear. They seem clear to even a lot of the practitioners.
Sure.
As well. This seems to be a uniform understanding.
Right.
That there is a underlying intolerance.
Nastiness to the whole thing. And
let's not even touch the old, I mean, even in the, well, in the New Testament, sure, but in the Old Testament.
You don't find a lot of preachers these days talking about these darker aspects of the Bible, and rightfully so, because they know that it's going to lose popularity.
It doesn't work. It doesn't fit. Work today.
So here we have, what do we have? We have an example of religion which is conforming to the progressive society around it, right? This is not, you know, these progressive ideas did not come from Christianity. They came from the intolerance of the general human consciousness of these nastier aspects of the religion. So, you know, so, okay, so that's kind of the first vein in which I appreciate the Reformation of Christianity, in that it's better for us as a whole, clearly, resulting in less human suffering and the destruction of human capital.
Sure, sure.
On the other hand, my contention is that it's not intellectually honest to have this reformed Christianity.
To any longer maintain this label.
This Reformation, this label, and still no call longer yourself a Christian. Yeah, I mean, if you have to, face the book, because you cannot rewrite the Bible. Remember,
sure. This
is an inflexible doctrine. This is the Word of God. This is, you know, and people will debate and say, yeah, well,
okay.
it was translated.
I want to find the importance of us asking that question. But firstly,
sure.
Some examples that I've had in my personal life, I've known Christians that have read the Bible front to back, Old Testament and New. They're absolutely progressive. They interpret the metaphors of the Bible. Well, they interpret it as metaphor that has a completely progressive outset. So they're okay with homosexuality. They're okay with accepting others. They're okay with interfaith unions.
I think what you see a lot of
things like that.
They, you know, they'll look at the darker stuff. It's cherry picking, I'm afraid. So they'll kind of look at the darker stuff, and they'll say, "Well, that's, you know, hey, that's metaphor. You're not interpreting that properly."
Well, they don't interpret it as
but
as,
the miracle
as dark
stuff
at all.
Is true.
They interpret it in a filtered context. And I've had Mormon friends even that have been very open to me, very kind to me, that I could call very good friends, and completely open to my lifestyle. Obviously, I'm a Satanist, so
we
were able to forge a very close friendship.
But at the end of the day, they believe that you're going to burn in hell. I mean,
well, actually, they believe I'm going to one of the three. Actually, as I understand in Mormon religion, you actually get to one of the three heavens unless you did really, really, really fucked up shit.
Really nasty. Okay.
Then you go to outer darkness. But other than that, you go to a lower heaven, which is absolute fantasy land. So you go to heaven no matter what. Most murderers actually get to heaven, too.
That's convenient, yeah.
Yeah, that works out, you know? It's actually not that
Why
bad.
Not?
Not a bad deal. But in my experience, I've seen this, and I have to say, I believe, I understand what you're saying, that we can't have, you know, Christianity used to mean this a few hundred years ago.
Mm.
And it used to be a literal interpretation of the Bible.
Yeah.
And we used to have these situations. But I believe there has to be room for an evolution of these religions. Because you're not going to wipe the religions completely off the face of the earth. You're not going to delete the luster that exists for these people to gravitate towards these religious faiths.
Yeah.
You're not going to remove them.
I think
so.
I want
to give room for Christianity to evolve. I want to give room for Islam to evolve. It needs to happen a little faster.
We don't have as much time with Islam as we did with Christianity. The technology is much more advanced and destructive.
No, we need things to happen a little faster.
Right.
But I think we need to give room for these things. Now,
actually, Shay, I think that the evolution of religion is an inevitable consequence of the underlying good human nature. So I think that's going to happen regardless. You know, so we're going to do – Christianity is going to do to itself what it's been doing, which is to get away from the nastier stuff, just because people by and large tend to not – have a blood thirst for each other. I mean, most people don't want to go out and maim other people.
So you're saying it's as a consequence of modernization,
yes,
that religion is forced to follow suit.
Religion is going to conform in such a way that it's nastier aspects are going to filter out over time, I believe, just as a natural consequence of a slight human goodness. You know, so over time, the slight human goodness multiplies out.
Wait, are you saying there's an innate human altruism? There's an innate kind of leaning towards...
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, us as social beings. So, and it's really just a matter of how we define our in-group and out-group. So I think that humans naturally have a positive inclination, a helpful cooperative inclination towards people in their in-group, right? I mean, this is how we survived in tribes and kind of got along within our homogenous kind of, tribes and communities, right?
Yeah, sure.
Now, there is, of course, the other end of that where we have the capacity for great hostility towards peers or people in the out-group, right? So other tribes, other religions, what have you. So we're not totally safe from division, but I think what's happening with modernity and what's happening as society evolves is we're starting, you know, people in general are starting to expand their in-group to include other people that you know, in previous generations and in previous centuries would not have been included in it. And so as a consequence of that expansion of the in-group, we're going to see a greater dispersion of this cooperation. And it's in that mechanism that we will see the extinguishing of the real destructive attributes that religion, that you know, religions sure. would foist upon sure, us otherwise. Sure, sure, sure.
But we see similarities between medieval Christianity and, say, ISIS. There is a literal interpretation of the Bible. Right. Or, in this case, the Quran.
Sure.
Sharia law.
Yeah, the problem of ISIS is actually that they're taking their religion a little too seriously.
Conversely, did you see the bashing of the artistic artifacts at Mosul?
God,
that
dude.
Fucking hurt, dude.
I actually just saw that last night on Facebook.
Fucking painful, dude.
They're taking sledgehammers.
Oh my
to
god!
Ancient artifacts.
That hurts,
these guys.
That
and they're doing. And they're fucking.
Hurts,
they're, and they're
dude.
And they're standing around with their smartphones and they're filming it and they're oh.
It's painful. It's absolutely
Can we just have a moment of silence? Just a few moments here to acknowledge the destruction. Yeah, so, right, so kind of getting back to orthodoxy and religion.
So you see the similarities between medieval Christianity and current ISIS right now.
Yeah.
And it took roughly 300, 400 years. We had to hit the Enlightenment, we had to hit certain revolutions, we had to hit certain currents in society.
It takes a while. These things, they have a lot of momentum and inertia. They take a long time. It takes a long time to steer the ship.
But do you see this literal interpretation of the Bible commonly expressed in a violent form, in an aggressive, brutal form? Do you consider this the caliphate? I mean, do you consider this, as a secular atheist, do you consider this the end-all be-all of what religion represents, of what Christianity and Islam represents?
You know, right. I think that, you know, the burning of witches and that sort of thing, you know, of course, the Bible doesn't specifically say thou shall burn witches, right? But so that violence was kind of an
Actually.
It was an extrapolation.
There's a reference to witches and poison, and there's actually a reference to witches in the New Testament, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. There's something. I don't know. Mm. It's been a very long time since I've seen this package, but sorry. Or so, this passage.
Yeah, sure, but, sure. But I think the violence that we saw in the medieval Christianity wasn't, you know, it was an extrapolation of a literal interpretation of the faith. It's that kind of strict interpretation that I feel is required. There's this one source of what it means to be Christian. There's this one source for Christianity.
You just admitted that this is a potentially false interpretation of the Bible. You said extrapolation. You said
right.
extreme extrapolation, which means this is potentially
maybe an exaggerated interpretation of of the text, which resulted in, you know, the extreme violence. But nevertheless, it came from this book.
Well, surely the keeping of slaves, the subjugation of women, this is not an exaggeration.
No, right.
This is a clear interpretation of the text.
The specific violence was maybe taken a bit too far. But yeah, even without that extreme extrapolation, there's a lot of nasty stuff that in modern society is simply inapplicable. And given that we're dealing with the Word of God here, we don't have the convenience of just saying, oh, well, we're going to cherry pick this and kind of leave the nasty stuff out and focus on the love of Jesus. Jesus, by the way, who said that there's nothing in the Old Testament that I'm here to denigrate or replace or say that does not still apply. So
the Old Testament's a shitstorm.
Yeah, I mean, certainly what you'll find in Deuteronomy and Corinthians is really dark, nasty stuff. In Genesis,
the clear anti-feminine message.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
is fucking. I mean, the metaphor, the poem. Well, I'm almost giving it. I'm almost giving it room for grace when I call it a poem.
Yeah. But anyway, if the Christian is kind of in this unfortunate position of being between a rock and a hard place, which is that the harsh and nastiness of the text that defines his or her religion versus what is applicable and tasteful and of color, in today's modern society. And I would say that they're totally incompatible. So, but what's happening is you have people reforming, calling themselves Christians, cherry picking from the book the things that they like,
sure,
leaving out the stuff,
sure, sure, sure,
that no longer applies, that if you enforce, you would go straight to prison for, leaving that stuff out. But so my contention is that this is, you cannot validly reform the religion. It's written. It's hard coded in the text of the Bible.
So
what's happening is,
mm-hmm,
is you actually have non Christians, people calling themselves Christians who are actually non Christians because they're deviating from the Word of God, but they somehow are still identifying with the term.
I understand where you're coming from, but Matt, you're an atheist.
Yes.
What purpose do you have to kind of say that or establish that these aren't Christian, these aren't Muslim?
Why am I
because
bother?
They're
why
not
do I bother?
These
why,
moderates.
Why am I interested? Why am I meddling myself?
What value does it have?
Why am I meddling in the concerns of Christians and
these are
and
religious
Muslims?
Folk?
Right.
You're trying to say they're not following their path.
Right.
I mean, what's your purpose in that? And what's the value in it?
Yeah, good, great question, actually. I see a lot of value in it. Because I feel like if we get people to honestly face the tenets of their faith, then we can get them to, we need to break, ultimately, my utopia, I would like to see kind of a broad abolition of religion, and not any kind of abolishment that's enforced by the state, or not any kind of laws or
you just
or
want
police
every,
state
you want
running
everyone
around
to unanimously decide
for themselves, kind of as individuals, to look at what
this
the
isn't
actual tenets
anymore.
Of their beliefs are.
That this isn't working anymore,
and to in an intellectually honest way, face the actual doctrine and see that it clearly does not apply and it clearly does not make sense. And so, if I can kind of plant that seed and ignite that flame,
yeah,
in an individual, then that's going to be the tool that ends up
sure,
kind of helping the world, saving the planet.
Sure, and I can completely sympathize with that
because we've seen historically, and we see contemporarily in the present day, the kind of damage that actual religious fervor does, that actual belief and steadfast faith in your religion does.
Sure. It's just going to be hard to sell that a secular atheist is able to tell a person of religion how steadfast they are applying themselves to the religious tenets.
It's all written for me. It's in the book. You know, it's in the Bible. Read it. You know.
What about the deistic approach? What about Thomas Jefferson and the Enlightenment that occurred in the early times of the colonial period?
Yeah, sure.
And in the Renaissance,
Jefferson did a great thing. He was, of course, very much ahead of his time, naturally, right?
Well, maybe we're just behind.
Sure, that's an interesting way of saying it. Yeah, of course, yeah. Well, we're behind him for sure, because what he did is actually wrote the Jefferson Bible, and he basically put into words an alternative version of the Bible that Christians in this day and age are basically living by, which is, you know, kind of get rid of the supernatural stuff and get rid of the nasty stuff.
A deistic approach to the whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, Jefferson strictly was a deist. Of course, I'm not perfectly in favor of deism myself, because there's still an element of supernaturalism.
I almost feel like deism, at least a few hundred years ago,
was
used as a mask for atheism.
It's a graduation.
Because
it's a small step. It's a baby step to get people to take.
Because you still had to, in that time, you still had to admit a certain amount of fervor towards the religious domineering
If you wanted to be taken seriously,
viewpoint.
Otherwise you would simply...
Oh, fuck.
You'd be...
If you completely denied...
At worst, you'd be excommunicated from your society.
At best.
At best. At worst, you know, you'd be stoned to death or burned or something.
Sure,
imprisoned for the rest of your life or something like that. Or quartered with horses or something, you know, something really nasty.
But
so, yeah, deism was a nice progression. He may have taken it further if the societal constraints weren't what they were at the time.
Well, they wanted to in the beginning. I mean, they wanted to separate church and state.
In fact, they did.
There was a powerful
people will argue that point today.
There was a powerful drive to release the American colonies of the religious domination that existed
that
prior.
That was kind of the whole point of leaving Britain in the first place. to
More
escape
or less,
the religious persecution of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
That's why, well, that's what they tell us. That's why the fucking Puritans came here.
You want, I get you right, because I'm interested in your view simply because I find it fascinating that an atheist...
enthralled.
So enthralled in...
Sure.
How... religionists would identify.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you had it your way, would they stop identifying with this religious faith, or would they become more progressive? Because in my idea, you're not going to strip them of their religion. They're going to adapt at best. There's going to be a shift of perception. You're going to have people who are worshiping Christ or Buddha.
You know what's funny?
Or Muhammad.
Yeah.
And they're going to be moderate. And they're going to be more accepting and tolerant. But I don't think you're going to remove them of their labels. They're not going to embrace an atheist umbrella. They're not going to say, you know what? Non-faith is just as inspiring as faith. It's not, I just don't think that's unbelief is just as
fulfilling, of course not.
Compulsive or
satisfying.
Or driving, satisfying as faith or belief.
You're not going.
It's not going to occur.
Of course not.
So
yeah.
what is your ideal? And the whole point of asking this question, the whole point of challenging.
Yeah.
Where?
You know. So okay. So
what's the end result?
Firstly, when religion is dissolved from an individual and atheism takes its place. Atheism does, in a lot of ways, fail to fulfill the void that's left in the religion's place. You don't get this rosy picture of the afterlife, and you don't get this consoling image of a father figure above looking out for your best interest.
Sure.
That's an inevitable consequence of losing one's faith. There's nothing exclusive about religion that grants us ethics. We're going to have ethics. Kind of gets back to my point. We're going to have a decent set of ethics in spite of religion, in spite of what religion would have us do. If given enough time to reform, we're going to dilute those negative aspects of what religion would dogmatically appreciate us enforcing some really nasty codes of law. Sharia law, you know, sure. Burning witches, stoning people to death, etc. So, sorry, what was the other – oh, what is my intro? What is kind of my – what is kind of – why am I so interested? Why am I so enthralled in the discussion of religionists? Well, again, you know, I feel like there's two reasons I'm really interested. First is almost merely academic, right? Which is, it's just kind of frustrating to have people call themselves something that they actually aren't adhering to. You know, so the first vein is just mere frustration. You know, kind of an academic incongruency. To say, yes, this is my holy book, I am a Christian, I you know, you could tear 75% of the pages out of this thing, and you can't do that and still call it, give yourself the name. You can't cherry pick. It has nasty stuff in it, it's the word of God, and you don't get to tell God, you don't get to tell God
which rules of the, which things. I think that's one of the more beautiful and graceful and redeeming aspects of our human nature and our society.
I totally agree.
Is that we're able to reconcile
yes.
the disgusting, brutal, violent,
again, we're going divisive to, we're going to come up
these biblical scriptures.
Yes, regardless.
And I feel like we need to allow people to do that. You're not going to delete religions, man.
You actually kind of regurgitated my point that I made earlier, which is we're going to arrive at a decent set of ethics despite our religion if given enough time anyway. But the point is, it's no longer the religion. It's no longer Christianity. You know, if you're going to allow gay marriage, and if you're going to allow sex before marriage, and if you know, if you're going to give women equal rights and the right to vote and all this and that, you're no longer a Christian, because in the book, it's very explicit, but very clearly stated. None of these things are Christian ideas. None of this equality is Christianic in any sense.
You know, so it's safe to say that in a conclusion type sentiment.
Conclusory.
Yeah, that although these may not be parts of the original biblical interpretation,
you're actually in favor.
I am more than happy for people to evolve religion in that direction. I am more than happy for them to deny the literal tenets of their biblical scriptures.
Right. I have kind of an interesting question for you then. I mean, how much of this book can we change and still call ourselves Christian then? How much of it can
if they're going to abandon everything in the fucking book?
When and who is going to rewrite the damn thing? I mean, and are they going to say that it was the word of God?
You know, if it's not rewritten, and if we have a group of people that completely change and select and cherry pick.
If the Bible's not rewritten,
I would be happy to have a group of progressive individuals, or at least accepting or tolerant individuals, bearing to the literal interpretation of the Bible, who are absolutely deistic or absolutely or Gnostic in the sense that they interpret the Bible metaphorically. I'm absolutely happy with that.
I'm actually happy with that too. But you know, you've said a couple of times that, you know, you're never going to divorce the planet. You're never going to divorce people from religion. You're never going to completely get rid of it. Well,
I don't think so.
I would say, Shay, to you that we're seeing the very beginnings of that happening now. It's a problem that's going to fix itself given enough time. People are already calling themselves Christians without being anything like a Christian. And
sometimes not even believing in God.
Yeah, this is the... maybe some point the majority of them will get to that level. But we're seeing the seedlings of religion vacating itself. Religion, people taking the namesake, but not taking any of the core values seriously, and that it's going to kind of erode from the inside out. And that is going to be the process by which if given enough time, religion will be eradicated from the planet, and we'll be better for it.
So for the artist segment, we're going to have Christopher Wilkie, my good friend. I've known him for some time. He's an absolutely amazing painter. You've had a chance to look at a little of his work, right, Matt?
Yeah. No, actually, I've been kind of going over his DeviantArt page here. Really mind-blowing work. Yeah, some fantastic
pieces. I've decided to bring him on just because he fits the bill for the kind of darker the better.
Absolutely.
So...
Dark art, to be sure.
Yeah, so without further ado, let's kind of get him on. And Chris, are you on the line?
Hey, I'm right here. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so how are you? Where are you right now? How are you doing?
Right now, I am in my basement at my house, and I'm doing very well. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good. We're getting acclimated to a new studio. It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been familiar with your work for some time, and I understand there's a kind of multi-layered approach to what you do. But without all that notwithstanding, there's a level of skill involved with your work that is absolutely impressive.
I appreciate that.
Hauntingly beautiful work. Very talented artist, and your images are, like I said, absolutely haunting. What's your experience? How long have you been painting? How long have you been expressing yourself in this medium?
Well, I discovered I was an artist I was probably about 4 years old. It's one of my earliest memories. I don't have a really good memory, so going back to the age of four is about as early as I can go. And I was sitting at the kitchen table with my father. He had off from work the one day, and he asked me, I was drawing some pictures, and he asked me to draw a picture of him. So very reflexively, I put the piece of paper between the two of us, and I drew him with my pen or my pencil or whatever I had, and I drew him upside down so that he could see it across the table from me.
No.
And I remember that he was really astonished by the fact that I did that, and I remember being really confused by that because it seemed very natural to me, because if somebody's sitting across from you, obviously you want them to see it, so that's the way I did it. And after that, into my teens and my 20s, when rebellion sets in and you want to express yourself, I decided that that was the best way to do it, because obviously I had a talent for it and I had a passion for it. Actually, passion is the way I define talent. I don't think anybody's born with skill. You just have something you're passionate about and you develop your skill, you cultivate yourself. After that, I started getting into painting. I had a private tutor for a while that was actually a spy for a covert Christian operation, which I can talk to you about if you want.
That sounds fascinating.
No, that's pretty interesting. I get to that if you want, bring it up later. Go ahead.
Yeah, so in your work, there's a almost like a surreal, torturous kind of extrapolation that I draw from it, looking at the continuity of your work, looking from your older pieces to your most recent series. There's almost like the torturous figure that seems central to a lot of your work. How is this tied to that kind of, has this evolved from your adolescent kind of oppositional, adversarial, rebellious phase? Is this an evolution of that? Or how has this evolved since then? And what is with the almost like the portrait, the solitary, torturous figure? I get an anti-hero feel to your work. Is this accurate?
I think that what you're trying to get at, which is what a lot of people ask me when they interview me about my work, is it autobiographical? And it definitely is. And I definitely use my own features in a lot of the faces that I paint. And I paint generally figures and faces, and they generally look like me in a little bit.
Yeah,
and,
I noticed that.
I think that it is an extension of an adversarial tendency that I've had since my teenage years, but I don't want to say that they're completely autobiographical because, it is a character, it's an extension, and, that extension of myself is definitely drawn upon from magical purposes like evocation or the supernal triad or trying to get in touch with the inner genius or whatever you want to call that thing. That's generally the portrait that I'm trying to paint when it's a portrait type of painting. So I don't think that adversarialism is generally as important to me now because, I'm 34 at this point. But I think that antinomy is definitely important. Just the looking at all sides of a spectrum and seeing sure. that all sides work, but all sides are adversarial to each other. And I find that fascinating.
Okay. So being that it's autobiographical in a sense, that's an attribute to the work, I noticed the in a few of these paintings, like the Philosopher's Stone, once again, absolutely fucking stunning. Absolutely stunning work. But like in the Philosopher's Stone, ruins, in these particular pieces, there's a disfigured character. There's a torturous disfigured character. How does that play in autobiographically? Does this coincide with your story in some way? You did mention magical evolution, evocation. Does this tie into like a spiritual story that you have?
Sure. I actually did very early on what it's recommended for magicians to do very later on, where I created my own religion in my teens. And I created characters for my art, and then I realized that I actually believed in those characters to such an extent that they were becoming a part of me, or was simply a part of me that I was externalizing. You're going to see a lot of similar themes in my work where we have an elongated phallus type of appendage off the back of the head.
Off the back of the head, yeah.
No mouth, one missing eye, things like that, or a demon or a godhead playing puppet master over a more human form.
Yeah.
And, these things are very inspired for me through my experiences with evocation and astral projection. Very often what I find is that I'll create a piece of art or a painting, and then I'll find that I don't really understand what it means until several years after. And I'll be sitting in my basement, which I am right now talking to you, but my brother will be sitting across me drunk, and he's my heterosexual life partner. He's my Twiggy Ramirez to my Marilyn Manson. And, I'll be drunk here and he'll be out there and we'll be sitting there and I'll all of a sudden realize what one of these paintings actually mean on a philosophical basis. And I'll be blown away by the fact that I painted that way before I understood what it actually meant. And, I think that my most recent representation of, Aegir, which is on my website, is a really good example of that.
So when did you get into the, because it seems like the occult has a heavy significance in your work. And more specifically from the occult, I extrapolate a left-hand path. That is to say, satanic, Luciferian, or what have you. I get a dark aesthetic, a dark satanic aesthetic, left-hand path aesthetic. Because I notice you, in a painting or two, you also have the clipote. You also have other occult symbolism. When has that started playing a role in your life, and how serious has it played a role in your spirituality?
What most people who are members of the Church of Satan or some satanic organization are supposed to say is that they came across the Satanic Bible when they were 13 and they read it and they realized themselves in it. That seems to be the general PR approach to the whole thing. Well, I'm gonna skew that a little bit because I like being honest, just to fuck things up a little bit.
Please
and,
do.
So, you know, I'm in the right place. I was 14 or 15, actually, or maybe even 16. I don't even remember anymore. And I was praying to God because I was in a really bad situation in my childhood. And I realized all of a sudden that I was praying to the corner of my wall. And the corner of the wall isn't going to help me. It was like talking to Santa Claus. And I was like, you know what? Maybe if God doesn't have anything to offer, maybe the devil does. Let's try it out.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum and see what happens.
Was this before your exposure to the Satanic Bible?
It definitely was before my exposure to the Satanic Bible. And the interesting thing is, I lit a candle because I realized just intuitively that the devil needs ritual, so that's all I had available. And I prayed to the devil. And I'll tell you what, not any more than 2 weeks later, the Satanic Bible fell into my lap. I read it, and I realized myself in it, and that's all there was to that. And since then, I realized the importance of what we were talking about the other night, pantheism, that these things are created as much as they are creators, just like we are created as much as we are creators.
That actually ties into a conversation we had earlier in the show.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. I mean, there's a give and take between all the things that we can't see that we try to communicate with and all the things that can't see us to try to communicate with us. And I've come to an understanding recently that it's improper, I think, for a person to say that anything that we can't define or measure by a scientific method or by a logical method, a left hemisphere of the brain method, doesn't exist. I think that really it limits the ability for a person to see their reality. If you have to have a definition for something in order to experience it, that definitely limits your reality.
So you champion the subjective experience.
I definitely champion the subjective experience because I think that the scientific method is a subjective experience. And I'm going to go into this a little bit if you want me to.
Sure.
I think that the occult is prototypical of all the hard sciences that we have nowadays. So that when we talk about sciences that are yet to be discovered, I think that that's basically a misnomer. I think that the occult is prototypical of hard science, philosophy, and religion. And I think that if you look at the occult, it gives you the basis of those three, if you want to call them sciences or belief systems or whatever. But I mean, what's the difference between science and religion? It's basically two very different, very creative ways of trying to explain the universe that we live in. And neither one can be proved. And I think that if you measure something, you say, well, it has to be measured in order to exist.
I tend to agree
with
you.
Direction, or if you look, I'm sure you do, and I'm sure that Matt doesn't.
Yeah, I don't mind being kind of the oddball.
Contrarian.
Yeah. Once again, I find myself repeatedly in this situation. That's okay. I don't want to interrupt you. Please go ahead, Chris.
No. It's totally fine. But
by calling it prototypical. Are you saying that the origination of these sciences comes from an occult understanding?
Absolutely. I'm saying
with you on that.
What we call primitive man had an occult understanding
of
the universe that was written down in symbolic terms because these people were wise enough to understand that the only way that this information could be translated through the ages was through art, was through the right hemisphere of the brain.
Yes.
It was through symbolism. It was through the subjective experience. You're not going to translate something through the left hemisphere of the brain, which is time, language, and mathematics, because that changes over time. The one thing that does not change in human evolution over time is the right hemisphere of the brain, the subjective experience. So they gave us art. They gave us the pentagram. They gave us the cross. They gave us astrology. They gave us alchemy. all those things developed from the very basic occult understanding of the universe, and we grew our sciences and our systems of control vis-a-vis religion out of that.
And these have been the most permanent symbols in our society.
They've built our society. They're extremely important. I'm not going to say that they're not, but some are systems of control. Some are ways for the people that want to be in control to box us into a corner. And some are ways for us to expand our consciousness. It simply depends on how you look at those, on how you look at those systems per se.
Okay. So occult being the prototypical standard for our current sciences, how do you feel about that, Matt?
Yeah, sure. For a long time, of course, in primitive man and human history throughout time, there is something, of course, very human, very rich and cultural about religious mysticism, religious experience, the arts, the languages. We have this, I don't want to say it's unique, but certainly the most profound expression of emotional dearth is in the human animal. We have this intellectual capacity as well. Chris, you're making reference to kind of right hemisphere and left hemisphere type of stuff. And for metaphor, I think that serves us well. But being human, we're kind of this unique complexity. We have this advanced intellect. And so.
Sure.
So what the arts and what metaphorical expression and what religious symbolism has done for us is an expression of how rich our internal experience is, how rich the subjective experience is as a human being. And certainly myself personally, being on the secular side of things, I do not wish to strip us of that poignancy, of that very central kind of core experience and expression.
Well, you're no longer human, you're a machine at that point.
But having said that, I think there's a big difference between the kind of the subjective experience and the objective experience in terms of how we can go about clearly defining reality. Tools like mathematics, mathematics is kind of the language of the universe. It's how things actually work. It's the actual relationships, gravitational relationships, biological, chemical, electrical. It wasn't until, kind of Nikola Tesla started experimenting in the ways that he did that we really had this technological boom. And this technological advancement came in a way that was not going to come from the primordial, the primitive man with all of the religion and mysticism he had in his toolbox. It was not going to come from there. It had to come from an objective science, from a mathematical understanding.
Despite the fact that so much occult significance has been drawn even from Nikola Tesla, though.
Well, it's true. And we have to remember that Nikola Tesla was really undermined by Edison, who was really the industrial engineer of the modern age. And
businessman.
Nikola Tesla was the theoretist. The theorist.
Sure.
What we have to remember is what I'm talking about is I'm talking about a correlation between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. I'm not talking about one to the exclusion of the other. I'm not saying that math is bad. I'm not saying science is bad.
Sure, yeah.
But what we have to remember is that Galileo, who is the father of modern science, which is simply just another system that we have for understanding the universe, which is predicated by the occult. When he died, they found that most of the books in his library were on alchemy. They weren't on anything else. And in the occult, you not only have alchemy, which gave us chemistry, you not only have but you also have astrology, which gave us astronomy, religion, which gave us philosophy.
Right. It's all human creativity at the end of the day, isn't it? I mean, it's all
that's it.
Whether
everything is subjective.
Yeah, so, Chris, I wanted to return back to your work, and looking over your pieces, I noticed, not with similar occurrence to what you're calling the autobiographical pieces, portraits, there's a female figure. You seem to be kind of fair-handed in depicting the male and female kind of dualism.
Well, and actually, I was kind of sorry, Shay, to interject, but I was actually kind of thinking this, looking over some of these pieces. You know, the male figures tend to be the ones that have some sort of disfigurement about them.
Yeah, good point.
The female figures, they're not disfigured, but there is definitely, there's a very specific look in the face of these women in your work.
Almost like a deleterious.
But you treat them distinctly differently, it seems.
But it seems like the female figure may also be the same. Is this a muse of some sort?
Yeah, that's where my work gets to an autobiographical point. I had a female in my life, and I hit a crossroads. I'm very into Joseph Campbell and the theory of the monomyth. And if your listeners want to look him up or read some of his books, specifically The Hero with a Thousand Faces, I think it's definitely worth your time if sure. you're capable of reading, which I don't think a lot of people are nowadays, but hopefully
we definitely are.
I hope so.
I know you guys are. I'm each day that goes by, I lose a little more faith in humanity, so I'm throwing that out there. But
we're a little misanthropic ourselves, yeah.
Sure.
I did have a woman in my life that there, if anybody's familiar with Robert Anton Wilson, he talks
Absolutely.
About a point.
He pulls the cosmic yeah. trigger. Pulling the cosmic trigger.
Exactly. And he talks about a point in the magician's practice where he runs into a place where the math no longer matches the terrain. And what happens with that point is, well, for me, and this is why it's an extremely personal experience, and that's why the math doesn't match the terrain, is because the woman was somebody that I was supposed to end up with, and it just didn't work out. And that's where, you know, I hit what Aleister Crowley, I guess, would call the abyss. It didn't work out. The map no longer matches the terrain. And I had a point in my life where I had achieved everything that I thought I wanted except for that one thing. And then that one thing ended up being unachievable. And so I think that's why the continence of the female in my work is definitely concrete, is because being a male, I take the subjective, you know, whatever the holy guardian angel is in Crowley's work.
Sure,
and
I noticed a piece here, Saint Anadonia and the Moon. And in this figure, I see the red moon, I see some Luna, female empowerment, the blood moon, the cycles, the women connected to the sacred cycle. But she also has a very
sure.
scornful expression. Is this tying into what you're telling us now?
Yeah, that was kind of my way to let her go. That was my painting to that, along with the Empress, which was a very specific set of circumstances that happened to me. But Saint Anadonia and the Moon, Anadonia means the inability to feel pleasure.
Oh, I'm familiar. I'm very familiar.
I'm sure. And, yeah. You know, the fact that she has her shoulder to me and she's looking back at me and she seems to be headed into the red moon of judgment was simply a way for me to express, I don't have to have her, but she was leading me somewhere, and that's what's important. And that was what was important for me in my personal life to figure out.
What's the symbol that's used in, for example, in the Philosopher's Stone, that symbol that's on his right hand, that is the symbol
yes.
of the Philosopher's Stone, is that correct?
Yeah, from what the alchemists have put forward, yeah.
I've seen this in a few of your works. What's the importance that plays in the continuity of your work?
Well, it's interesting. I don't really understand it completely yet to a mathematical point where I can describe it in language, but I think that the relationship between the triangle, the circle, and the square have a really important, something important to tell us philosophically about ourselves or our condition or how to progress. And I put it on the hand so that it was engraved, and it looks like I tried to make it look like, hopefully it translates well in the image, I tried to make it look like I was whispering into it and at the same time listening to
it. Finish your thought, please.
So that's where I was coming from with that particular painting, and I have some other occult symbols and a few other paintings, but the only other thing I wanted to say was generally I don't incorporate occult symbols into my painting as they're generally known, because I try to work on what I was talking about before, the right hemisphere of the brain, because that's where I'm most comfortable.
Sure.
And I think that occult symbols are a translation from the right side of the brain to the left side of the brain.
Okay.
To try to translate information. And when I go to the source, it comes in to me from an intuitive sense. So I try, like my painting, the Magus, my most recent representation of the Magus, I didn't want to look at tarot cards or look at astrology or the occult. I wanted to make a painting that was visceral, that was animalistic, that described the emotional impetus of that ascension.
Okay.
What does a person feel when they no longer have their own ego in place and their ego is replaced by what their godhead, which what feels like at that point of ascension, it feels like an alien being inhabiting your body. And I wanted to describe the visceral sensation that goes along with that rather than simply communicate myself through obtuse occult symbolism.
So if there is one... this may be a difficult question to ask such an artist that's taken on such a variety of forms of expression and ideas, but if there is a single cause that you want to champion, or if there is a single direction, or if there there's an overlying message to the dialogue of your work, what would that be?
All right. Be true to thyself, but follow me, but don't believe in anything I say.
Fantastic.
Perfectly said. What's the absolute, once again, Christopher Wilkie, one of the absolute stunning, absolutely talented, shockingly beautiful, torturous expressions from a master
of his craft.
His craft.
Definitely.
What is the best place for people to find your work, to participate in your art, and maybe to purchase?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's people that should be dying to have some of these in their home, some of these prints. What's the best place to direct these people to find your work?
Well, the first place to find my work is on an album cover that's currently coming up. And it's by an artist or a band. I don't even know. It's Shay DeLay. I'm not really sure.
Oh, yeah, of course. I do have an album that I'll be releasing in the next few months. And I did have the esteem pleasure of Christopher painting the album cover. And I'm very, very excited and humbled to have that opportunity. Thank you so much, Chris.
Whoa.
But that is not the best place. I'm honored.
I'm very excited and humbled to be included in the project, but I want people to look out for that. So that's
thank you so much.
Foremost.
Thank you so much.
And after that, if you want to keep up on what I'm doing, go to ChristopherWilkie.net, not .com, because that's some fruity loot player that I'm not familiar with. But ChristopherWilkie.net, WILKE.net, and you can check out my paintings and see what I'm up to, and I got links to Tumblr and Facebook and all that on.
Okay, we'll shoot all of Chris's links in the description for the podcast so you guys can reach them. Is there anything else you want to add, Chris, Before we go, before we end things.
I'm in love with you, and I hope that we can go out on a date when I come to visit California.
The next time you come to the West Coast, we're all going to have a group sexual experience, and you're going to make a torturous, a disfigured painting of it later.
Hey, listen, is Matt involved in that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, are you kidding me?
Nice.
Yeah. Chris, I love you. I love your work. You've been an inspiration for so many years, and I hope many people gravitate to your work and are also as inspired as I've been.
Likewise. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
No, Chris, thank you so much.
Pleasure to have you here.
Yeah. Have a great night. Take care.
You too.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Bye. Thank you for listening and lending your ears to the Deferred Gnosis podcast.
Please use the contact information in the description below. You may reach us at deferredgnosis.com. You may also find us on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, iTunes, etc. Or reach us by email at deferredgnosis@gmail.com.
Please send us your topic ideas, suggestions, things you might want us to discuss. Help us carve out a niche of truth, reaching some ground just on the edge of the fringe. And if you are a musician, a writer, a poet, artist of any kind, please feel free to send us a link to your work, audio or otherwise. We'd be more than happy to plug your work and possibly interview you for the show.
But remember, we have a penchant for the subversive, so the darker, the better.
So we're going to close out this show with a song called Eulerian Path by Anagnorisis. It's wonderful black metal out of Louisville, Kentucky. I hope to interview them in a future podcast, but you'll find their information in the description below. Thank you for listening.
And highest cheers from Deferred Gnosis.
Ave, hails, as above, so below.
They're going to run harder.